language was seen as a category which could bring people together, could provide a better accommodative principle, which had a democratic potential.
Many of these questions, language and culture and national affirmation, are simply part of the tissue of a complex country.
Because language has been seen as a compromise, it has kind of set the tone to approach other types of language. We're always compromising.
The challenge for us and what we put forth of Indigenous languages is this is the only space that you can find them. Once a language here is completely dormant, we can't go to France to get language education books.
Language has a lot of different dimensions. Language and politics is intertwined in South Africa.
This is Forum Fedcast, Episode 10, Language Policy and Federalism, Part 1, Tongue-Tied or Speaking My Language. In November 2021, the CEO of Canada's largest airline sparked a national controversy after delivering a speech to business leaders from the Montreal Chamber of Commerce. In his first public appearance as head of the company, Michael Rousseau got more than he bargained for when he addressed the audience in Francophone Quebec's largest city exclusively in English. Following his speech, Rousseau was lambasted for his failure to deliver his speech in French, receiving criticism from, among others, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, as well as serious condemnation from various Quebec government ministers. Coming in the context of an ongoing national conversation about the protection and promotion of French in Canada, this embarrassing interlude for the Air Canada boss highlighted not just the lack of political savvy of one language-challenged corporate chief executive, but also the significance that language has in federal countries characterized by diversity.
Language is a fundamental marker of individual and collective identity, directly associated with expression of culture and a feeling of belonging to a particular group, community, or nation. Language is especially important to linguistic minority communities who want to maintain their distinct group and cultural character. Language is also an emotive issue. As an expression of identity, it has been a factor in violent conflict between different groups, notably in the Balkan Wars of the 1990s and in current-day Cameroon. The significance of language is recognized by the international community. Several articles of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights establish individual linguistic identity as part of the international human rights framework, while the Charter of the Fundamental Rights of the European Union prohibits discrimination on the basis of language and obligates the Union to respect linguistic diversity.
Language policy is a complicated issue in any country made up of different linguistic communities. Federal systems of governance are often seen as well-equipped to accommodate socially complex societies characterized by ethnic, religious, cultural, and linguistic diversity. But some federal countries are also some of the most linguistically diverse nations in the world, which presents a challenge to governments from the local to the national level. How do federal countries approach the use and protection of languages within the state apparatus? How can governments ensure that citizens can access services, participate in policy and decision-making, and hold elected officials accountable in a country where tens or hundreds of different languages are spoken? How can you protect the rights of minority linguistic groups to operate and interact with institutions in their mother tongue, in the face of political contestation and resource constraints? And how can federations balance using language as a socio-cultural glue to foster national unity, while protecting and institutionalizing linguistic diversity?
In this series, we're delving into the fascinating but fractious issue of language policy and federations, taking in the historical context, socio-cultural dynamics, and contemporary debates on language policies in countries on three continents, North America, Asia, and Africa. So join us while we avoid the jargon and adopt the lingo as we explore language and federal and multi-level governance.
Language policy is a complex, multidimensional topic in many federal countries. And, because of that, we can't really squeeze all of the interesting dynamics into just one episode. So, we're doing a two-part mini-series. In this episode, we'll explore why language is such a significant consideration for people and governments in federal countries. And we'll set the stage for the state of language policy and the key language dynamics in our three focus countries, Canada, India, and South Africa. Then, in part two, we'll take a deep dive into how language policy interacts with government institutions and service delivery, focusing on the key area of language in education.
But before we get to those specifics, why is it that language issues resonate so strongly within diverse countries?
Well, language is part of what people feel and how they think and how they interact as individual human beings.
Leslie Seidel is a public policy consultant and senior advisor of the Forum of Federations. As project manager, he oversaw the Forum's Language Policy and Federalism Research Program, which explored issues of language and governance in 12 federal and federal-type countries around the world.
Most people learn one language when they're small. That may expand when they go to school. But the first language that they've learned, often called mother tongue, is by definition something that's the closest to their heart, to their sense of who they are. It's the lens they know best. But of course, the language is also a tool of social interaction. It's the basis of community.
As language is such a fundamental aspect of expression, especially in multilingual countries, it plays a key role in affirming individual and collective identity, both positively and sometimes negatively.
In almost every country where language has been a very large issue, there are, in a sense, two dimensions. One is affirmation, language as a dimension of what it is to be a community, whether it's a relatively small one, for example, the Romanche, who live in the south of Switzerland, a very small community, some of the indigenous communities in a few of the countries we studied, including Canada and Nepal, that may have only just a few hundred members and they're concentrated in a fairly small area. But in some cases, these communities are much more spread out and much more numerous. So there's the affirmation side. But language can also be a source of opposition and even conflict, where, for example, historically, people may have been discouraged or even banned from speaking the language of their minority community, and as a result of developments, acquire more rights. But as part of that process, they've often had to stand up to the dominant group in society. Some cases, the dominant group may not actually be the numerical majority where they live. So there's these two dimensions there, and they can be very powerful drivers of conflict, in some cases leading to violence and even civil war.
Language can be particularly powerful in highly diverse societies. In countries like India, linguistic diversity adds to the complexity of a pluralistic society, where language is an important consideration in the political and governance landscape.
India is not just multilingual, multicultural, but also very complex and dense when it comes to linguistic diversity.
Asha Sarangi is a professor at the Center for Political Studies at Jawaharlal Nehru University and a co-author of the case study on India in the Forum's Language Policy Research Program.
And like other societies of the world, languages have been identified with people's identities quite prominently. And for a very, very long time, even before we became independent, language was one of the mobilizational category used during the colonial period. And since then, language has come into the field of political mobilization, into the field of electoral democracy, federal forms of arrangement of powers, or you can say overall in terms of the idea of the state making and nation building.
In linguistically diverse societies, and particularly in federations, language is not just a symbolic expression of individual and collective identity. It conditions how people interact with each other and how they engage with government institutions and public services. In some federal countries, language has been seen as so critical to how people live their daily lives that it has been a key criteria in the territorial delineation of the country.
The language concentrations of where these communities live may be one of the main guidelines when boundaries are set, when previously unitary states are divided up, or when separate entities decide to come together to form a federation. There are many more of the federal countries in the world are in the first category because a number of them were created either at the end or leading towards the end of a colonial regime.
Both at the sociological level and I would say at the ethnological political level, language has played a very, very important role because unlike religion, which proves at times to be a problematic category and In case of India, the country was divided in 1947 based on the religion between Hindu and Muslims, the two countries that were formed.
The two sovereign countries of India and Pakistan.
So language was seen as far more secular, which had a democratic potential, a category which could bring people together, could provide a better accommodative principle for people who had to now come under one sovereign authority called state, or you can say a post-colonial state.
In the Canadian case, the issue of language has coloured the country's history, politics, and territorial structure since the very beginning.
Language was considered in the development of Canada as a way to accommodate Quebec. And then it was seen as an important tool as well, being instrumentalized by political party around Quebec nationalism. Language was always viewed, and is still viewed, as an issue for national unity.
Linda Cardinal
is Assistant Vice Rector Research
at the Université de l'Ontario Français and an Emeritus Professor at the School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa. She is a co-author of the Canada case study in the Forum's Language Policy Research Programme.
That is really how it has been defined in Canada, and it has been defined to accommodate French and English, the two majorities. In Quebec, French is the official language. And when we talk about Quebec, we tend to say that the approach is more territorial. We want to reinforce the language on its territory, not necessarily just the individual right to your language. All Quebecers have the right to work in French. All Quebecers have the right to an education. It's different from the other provinces. And then you have New Brunswick, who's another case where French and English are both official languages and where there's no designated area. And then locally, some cities have French language policies, like Ottawa or Moncton. There's bilingual municipalities in Manitoba. And then you have education policy with language requirements.
In India, linguistic diversity was an influential factor in the transition from a British colonial territory to an independent sovereign nation. But more than that, it also had an impact on the structure of the new Indian federal state.
The Congress Party, which was at the forefront of anti-colonial nationalism, was seen as an elite party because it had mostly prominent English-speaking leaders who were educated abroad and really not seen as a mass political party which could actually bring in mass movement. And Gandhi realized it, and therefore in 1920, when he came back into the national movement, he reorganized the Congress Party under 20 different units based on 20 different language groups. And these languages were identified with 20 different, you can say, provinces or states at that time. And this is how you can see the language category was brought into the forefront of the political movement in case of India. And since then, language has played a very, very significant role, both in terms of communalizing the issue at times, but also in terms of assembling, accommodating, bringing people together.
Since the emergence of an independent India in the late 1940s, and now in 2024, language has played a crucial role in the territorial structuring of the Indian state.
So the idea was the prominent regional languages, dominant regional languages, which were counted as 14 languages, which also entered the constitution of India under the 8th schedule, would be made the basis of 14 new states. Because we had 550 plus princely states and centrally administered areas and provinces that were directly governed by the colonial state. All of this had to be as if rearranged in terms of the 14 states, which will now be part of the Indian Union. So that's why Indian federalism is not where the states created the union, but union created the states, the centrally administered states. So you can say the weak federalism model or quasi-federalism model, where center has a stronger position than the states. So in some ways, you can see the journey of the language as a category of political participation, political mobilization, political socialization starts very early on. And gradually, more states were formed on the basis of language. But it's now in the year 2000 when we created three more states. And in year 2014, the last state, Telangana, which was broken off from Andhra, it was not based solely on the language principle. But the architectonic design of Indian federalism, it has taken into account ethno-linguistic criteria very, very seriously.
One of the best examples of how connections between language, identity, and territorial boundaries are understood in a particular country is through the concept of an official language. The official languages of a country, whether it's unitary or federal, are often formally established within the Constitution. In multi-level, multilingual countries like South Africa, the Constitution provides the foundation for the treatment of language across the nation.
The South African Constitution has dedicated a section that speaks to language and the choice of language and the use of language and identifies which languages are recognized as official languages of the country. So that's sufficiently clear for the general public.
Michelle Maziwisa is the program manager for the Human Rights and Democratization in Africa Master's Program at the Center for Human Rights at the University of Pretoria. And, as you may have guessed, she's also the author of the South African case study in the FORMS Language Policy Research Project.
And also in terms of the constitution, in terms of just understanding the system of government, we have three spheres of government. We have the national government, the provincial government, which would be the equivalent of regions, and then we have the local government. So what the constitution does is it allows each sphere of government to determine the language that it's going to use. So at least two of the official languages. What you tend to find is that in the provinces, there's English, Afrikaans, and an African language typically used by government in the administration, at least on paper.
So, language can be a useful dimension in decision-making about the linguistic foundations of a country, and in how a country can be divided up territorially on the basis of its different communities. But languages are also very fluid, and importantly, they move around with the people who speak them.
People don't always live in neat zones where on one side of a border it's 99% German speaking and the other side of the border it's 95% French speaking. It isn't always, even in countries that have largely unilingual subnational units like cantons and so on, even in countries like Switzerland, which has the clearest example of it, people move around and take up work or go to have education or for other reasons in another part of the country. And so what's called the territorial model is not always a perfect fit with the dispersion of the population.
This raises the tricky issue of language minorities, communities living in an area who speak a language that is not the dominant or official language of that area. In a hugely linguistically diverse country like India, with the potential for hundreds of linguistic minority groups, this creates a number of governance challenges.
Within every state, and this was the anxiety and concern on the part of our first prime minister also, that not only you are creating a majority language state, a state which will have one language as the dominant language, but you will also have many language minorities, many subgroups, many linguistic minorities. How will you ensure their equal partnership in running the state, in getting the other benefits that citizens should have?
In federations where the constituent units are established along linguistic lines, the potential for the perceived or actual exclusion of minority language groups can be a source of conflict. In India, a sophisticated language classification system, which formally determines the status of different languages throughout the country, was developed to provide an organizing framework for language in the state. But even this process of classification can be highly sensitive, especially for language minorities who fear they will be dominated by the majority language in a particular region.
So this classification of languages through census, through gazetteers, through several other survey reports was a way to straighten the linguistic diversity in some way, to categorize it, to bracket it, and then provide some kind of a political rationale for the new states to be seen as language-based states. For example, in case of Punjab, the Punjab reorganization happened in 1966. The whole idea of Punjabi Suba, that is Punjabi state, spoken by predominantly Punjabi-speaking people, But there were people who refused to be counted as Punjabi speaking. They didn't want to be under the domination of one particular community. So the question of community identity, community rights, and resistance to that dominant community identity also began to play a very significant role in this entire process of census taking. There were communities which actually refused to be counted as speaking a particular language because they knew if a particular language is shown as numerically majoritarian language, then they will actually be subsumed under that political border and boundary of a state where they might not be able to use their language.
So, dividing up a country into different geographical areas according to language is quite likely then to create language majorities and minorities within the different units that make up the country. However, the territorial dimension is only one side of the sociolinguistic story in federal countries.
Federalism also allows for a recognition of linguistic communities that may not necessarily fit so perfectly with the borders of states or provinces. If you were to ask somebody, a person who knows something about government, what's the first thing that comes to mind when I say the word federalism? I think most people would probably answer, well, that's when a country is divided up into units, states, provinces, cantons, and so on. So there's a geographical map, 10 provinces and 3 territories, as in Canada, 26 cantons in Switzerland, and so on. But underneath that geographical map is another map, the map of society. And that's where you will find, for example, indigenous communities, which in some countries have designated areas.
Canada, for example, has a large number of indigenous communities, many of whom have their own languages. But in the Canadian context, these minority languages haven't really been accounted for in the development of the federal state.
Language issues in Canada, especially since the 19th century, they were basically the thing of the French and the English. And, you know, we've excluded right from the start Indigenous languages in our framework, in our constitution. And so it has defined how we address language. The English is first, and then French, and then other languages. And so we've all been fighting amongst each other to get some recognition by the English, if you want to say, and we are not equal in that fight. So there is a hierarchy of languages in Canada, and that, I think, is a first principle to understand when we discuss language, not only in Canada, perhaps everywhere in the world, there's always this hierarchy.
If language hierarchies do exist in multilingual countries, why is that a problem? Well, language isn't just an expression of identity. It's also the means by which individuals and communities engage with state and public institutions, access government services, and participate in civic life.
Language is used in different contexts. One of the ways in which language is used is in government administration. So how the government interacts with the public, how government officials interact among themselves, how politicians interact, for example, in parliament or in municipal councils and so forth. And then language is also used in education as a language of instruction and what options are available in that sense.
When we have a language policy, it interacts with other kinds of policies as well. So if you have an indigenous language policy, it interacts with education, with employment, with the justice sector, and it's the same with official languages. So, you know, we really need to address this in a holistic fashion.
So how can governments provide services and other public resources in a scenario where there are many different languages which need to be accommodated? In many multilingual countries, governments apply the where numbers warrant principle as a way to balance inclusiveness with the availability of resources.
Public resources are not infinite. Governments have to make decisions about who is eligible for different services. Language is one of the criteria that is used, but it's not the only one. Obviously, benefits for childcare don't apply to everyone. There are criteria there. That's the way laws and public administration work. So many countries will, and provinces and territories will have something that's like where numbers warrant. And now where numbers weren't has to be decided administratively, and of course could be challenged in courts and so on. But it does mean that very small communities, and this is particularly relevant to indigenous communities in the places where this is an issue, they will maybe not get any services, or they will get fewer services than if they were numerically larger. That's unfortunate, but it's simply an outcome of numbers and decisions that have to be taken about how public resources are used. Now, countries can, or provinces and states can, decide to move the lever more towards the generous end. That may be a result of political pressure, it may be a result of a change of government, a government that's more open to the diversity of the society. But all these questions are ongoing.
What is important to understand here is that because language has been seen as a compromise, it has kind of set the tone to approach other types of language. We're always compromising, giving up something in order to be accommodating either the dominant group or the minority group, always giving up something. It is our way of addressing language for national unity reason, which means that when we adopt a language policy, you have the right to French language services, for example, where numbers warrant. Where numbers warrant is because we want to make sure that it is in areas where the numbers are there and it won't upset anyone. We have that kind of approach, and it guides our approach to language policy. And I've seen the same thing in Wales as well, the same kind of pragmatic approach where you have language rights or language policy where reasonable and feasible.
It's clear that language matters, but the unique historical, social, and cultural circumstances of a country affect the dynamics of its language challenges and conflicts. In order to understand language policy in federal and multi-level systems, we're going to have to delve deeper into some specific country cases. So, for the rest of this episode, that's exactly what we'll do. Starting with India. In India, the language classification system has been very influential in the way in which languages have been adopted and integrated into the state.
Languages were counted, but it was not simply counting the languages, but languages were also classified and categorized. So the idea of mother tongue comes into picture very prominently, and early on, 1961, after the independence, the figure of the mother tongue, which has been used for a very long time to provide the idea of multilingualism or multilingual education in India, is cited as 1652, even though that number has been challenged and new number has been added now. The point remains that classification of languages provided a logic, you can say an ethnological order and logic, to assemble the society or to reorganize the society in a certain way. But it also meant that religion and language began to be seen as intertwined, because in India, which is not just multilingual, is also multicultural and multireligious. So this relationship between language and religion acquired a deep political and communal overtone for a long time. It was only after the independence that language was seen or used in a more secular sense.
The combination of classification of languages and the strong association of language with group identities in India means that language has social and political capital among linguistic groups who want to advance their language rights within governance institutions. An official or scheduled language confers a sense of national legitimacy in the context of the Indian state. So, as Asher explains, there is a real motivation for language minorities to gain that status.
The classification of languages and classification of dialects or sub-dialects and smaller languages, minor languages, languages of the tribal communities, minority language, all this has been going on for more than 150 years. And that has given a certain kind of an ethnological basis for the political articulation of the demands by these different language communities and groups. Furthermore, to add to their demand for the separate state. Separate doesn't mean a demand for secessionism, which has been actually not permitted as per the Indian Constitution, but they can ask for more democratic rights for their languages and language communities of a certain kind. The diversity issue becomes very interesting to see how languages are also seen as if they are competing social capitals and cultural capitals. They're not simply markers of identity, but they have entered the market rationality to some extent. And which language should be given more prominence than the other is a hugely difficult issue for the state at any point of time.
Since independence, the number of scheduled languages recognized in India has increased slowly over time. But despite the widening of the official linguistic landscape, there are still many linguistic minorities living in the country.
Today we have 22 languages, but these are once again major languages. They're not minor languages. They're languages of each state majorly spoken. So the question of communities and minority languages is very complex and has been around for a long time. Whom do you characterize as a minority community or minority group based on their numbers in a population? So any community which is relatively smaller in size, having less privileges than the majority community in different aspects of life, is characterized as a minority community. But when it comes to the question of linguistic minorities, which actually alarmed the constitution makers from the beginning, because not all languages are spoken by a large number of people. So what kind of constitutional protection, constitutional safeguards, constitutional rights would be given to linguistic minorities?
The Indian Constitution sets out the principles for the protection of minority languages. But not only does it establish language rights for all Indians, it also includes a mechanism to help ensure that the needs of linguistic minorities are taken into account in the business of government.
About the linguistic minorities, there are many provisions within the Constitution, both in fundamental rights and their separate constitutional provisions, which come under Part 17, under specific articles, which in a way enshrine the principle that the linguistic minorities must be given the right to retain their languages. The state must make efforts to provide education in their languages. And not just education, must also provide the protection and preservation to retain these languages through various provisions, through writing of textbooks, through schools, through education, by making them the languages of market, of culture, administration, and so on and so forth. Even though it is said so in the constitutional provisions, it doesn't happen that easily on the ground. So there is another provision that the Indian Constitution provides, which I think is very interesting and also very important to bear in mind, which is called the Commissioner for the Linguistic Minorities, the Office of the Commissioner of the Linguistic Minorities, which prepares its report every now and then, once in 10 years, and presents it before the president of the country to show what the status of particular linguistic minorities in different parts of the country is. And based on that, which is then presented by the president to the parliament and both houses of the parliament, the further legislation and policies are made to protect and preserve the interests and the rights of the linguistic minorities.
And in India, the issue of majority-minority language rights has important implications for the functioning of the world's largest democracy.
I think this whole idea of majority-minority complex based on the language identity and affinity has also affected the electoral democratic order to some extent. And how do we make sure that the kind of deliberative democracy one talks about, which is an essential ingredient of a democracy, or you can say parliamentary democracy in case of India, a hugely complex parliamentary democracy in the country, where people need to understand the language of each other as well as the language of the political elites who are ruling over them, or they need to enter into some kind of a deliberative negotiation. And that's only possible through linguistic skills or linguistic resources. So language has also been seen as a very important category of recognition, representation, and resource redistribution.
Despite the sophisticated mapping and classification of the linguistic landscape in India, which has been developed over many decades, the sheer diversity and complexity of language in the country means that language policy remains a complex and ongoing issue.
The question of linguistic minorities, despite being a matter of concern since the beginning of the constitution-making process, has not yet been fully resolved, because even we don't know how many linguistic minorities still are not counted and are not part of our survey reports. How do you actually count a linguistic minority as a minority? Because in the rationalization of counting, any language which is spoken by less than 10,000 people doesn't even enter the register of the census. It's a huge country. So many languages, therefore, might not be even getting their voices in the records and reports of the census registers or other survey reports. Therefore, people don't even know that there are languages exist. It's only when there is a demand for some kind of an affirmation of an identity or some kind of autonomy demand, both politically and culturally in different parts of the country, within a state or on the border area, that the state takes cognizance of it. But the whole idea of linguistic minority is also seen as a cultural minority, which makes it even more complicated when you club language as part of your culture. And culture being a category which is not so easily definable, which is seen always in terms of value or specific belief system, pattern of life, and so on and so forth.
Like India, Canada is a multilingual country with significant and politicized majority-minority language dynamics. As Linda mentioned earlier, traditionally, language debates have centered around the accommodation of Anglophone and Francophone communities within the Canadian polity. But historically, the languages of Canada's Indigenous peoples have been the most neglected part of the country's linguistic landscape. And to understand the challenges of Indigenous minority languages in Canada, we need to understand a little about how language fits into the wider context of Canada's own violent colonial history, and specifically the systematic oppression of Indigenous communities over many decades.
With respect to how language in Canada has evolved in its treatment of Indigenous languages, when Canada started to first become a nation on our territories, there was a policy push to eliminate Indigenous languages and cultures.
Miranda Huron is the Director of Indigenous Education and Affairs at Capilano University in British Columbia. She is co-author of the Canada case study in the Forum's Language Policy Research Project.
As the agreements around signing treaties were happening, the treaties themselves were written in English, and there are conflicting arguments on what was actually agreed to within that space. So it creates this area where English is considered dominant, and Indigenous languages and even the use of oral history was attempted to be erased. That changed with the Delgamuukw decision and respect for Indigenous oral histories. There's still the passing down of our treaty agreements through ceremonies and the continued relaying of what was agreed to from the perspective of Indigenous peoples within those treaties.
One of the most shameful expressions of the state oppression of Indigenous peoples was the residential school system. From the 1880s until the late 1990s, the Canadian state forcibly removed Indigenous children from their families and placed them in residential schools, which were educational institutions funded by the state and run by churches that were designed to assimilate Indigenous children into Euro-Canadian culture. At residential schools, Indigenous children were separated from their communities and forbidden from speaking their mother tongues and practicing Indigenous culture. Many were subjected to physical, sexual, and psychological violence, and the resulting intergenerational trauma continues to have profound effects on residential school survivors today. In 2007, the Canadian government established the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or TRC, to document the history of the residential school system and to provide an official record of its impacts on survivors. In its 2015 report, the TRC stated that the treatment of children within the system amounted to cultural genocide, and the suppression of language was a key element in the attempt to strip away the children's Indigenous heritage.
With the movement into Canada's relation with Indigenous populations and the establishment of the Indian residential school system, that was the most active space of pulling families apart and disrupting that intergenerational linguistic transfer. And so children were penalized for speaking their languages. They were returned home when they were finally allowed to go home and frequently couldn't communicate with their families anymore. And this caused intergenerational traumas, problems that we still live with today, and has led to this space where we are considered by UNESCO to have nationally all of our language in a state of being critically endangered. The challenge for us and what we put forth of Indigenous languages compared to minority official languages in Canada is this is the only space that you can find them. So once a language here is completely dormant or gone, we can't go to France to get language education books. So there is a priority and an urgency to ensuring that these languages remain healthy and that there is a language resurgence amongst particularly our youth. But it's also important for us to focus on parents so there's that continued family language dynamic.
Canada is still reckoning with the treatment of its Indigenous peoples and the injustices that they have been subjected to. So where does the issue of Indigenous languages fit into the broader conversation around reconciliation? As things currently stand, English and French remain the only official languages, which presents challenges for Indigenous minority language groups.
One of the challenges that we face is that if an Indigenous speaker comes in, they have learned English, they have learned French, so there's an expectation that their human rights are protected in the same way that every Canadian has the right to access to healthcare and justice in their own language. But given that you're brought up with contact with English, French, that knowledge of the language can preclude you from being able to access services. So we have plenty of situations, and the BC Health Report goes into it, where people are denied service in their language, or people do not understand what's happening within the justice system. There are many injustices because people don't fully understand the processes that they're being subjected to. Not having access to services in your language, not only is it an inconvenience, but it can be life or death for many people. And it's so challenging.
In the wake of the TRC report, some attempts have been made to recognize and enhance the status of Indigenous languages in Canada. The 2019 Indigenous Languages Act, which was developed in consultation with Indigenous language communities, was designed to respond specifically to the calls for action on language and culture which were made in the TRC report.
A large section of the Act was devoted to the Office of the Indigenous Language Commissioner, when that was a direct recommendation within the TRC calls to action. And that office has now been established. It was established under COVID, so it took longer than expected to be set up. But we do have a former chief, Ron Ignace, who is our Indigenous Languages Commissioner, and the office is there and is really rolling out in a good way. There was an establishment of funding channels, so there was that priority of having Indigenous-led governance over the funding, and where there were provincial or territorial organizations that would work as good funding distributors and allowing more autonomy over how language revitalization funding was distributed, those channels have been established. And so there's been a lot of work that reflected both what we heard nationally and within the recommendations of the TRC. Funding has increased incrementally. It started with a major boost while we were doing the legislation and has been going up. We're hoping to see that continue because it doesn't equate to the costing analysis of what it will actually cost to do proper language resurgence within our country.
Revitalizing Indigenous languages and providing resources to protect and promote language diversity, particularly at the local level, is especially important in a context where, as we heard earlier, public service provision operates on the where numbers warrant principle.
Linda brought up this idea of where numbers warrant. So for Indigenous communities, this is a very scary approach because we have communities where the entire community is 120 people. Their numbers will never warrant by Canadian government standards. And so we need to be looking at the regionalism of languages and stepping away from the imposed borders, the imposed idea of where communities are, and understanding as well that many times these territories overlap. And within Canada, that due to all of the history of Canada, we have an immense Indigenous diaspora. There are huge Inuit and Cree communities in Ottawa, for example. The Cree community here in Vancouver is massive. So those considerations have to be made for how our populations are distributed across the country.
As in Canada, the legacy of colonialism and its enduring impacts on perception of language and identity has had a significant impact on language policy dynamics in our third country of focus, South Africa. The influence of colonialism on language in South Africa is reflected in the fact that Afrikaans and English are today two of the country's 12 official languages and are inextricably linked to the historical development of the country.
The history of South Africa is, in a nutshell, that in 1652, Dutch settlers arrived in the Cape. And with that arrival came the introduction of Dutch, the language Dutch, which then evolved into present day Afrikaans. But it's not the same original language Dutch that was imported, but it has been affected and in many ways has become a form of Creole with influences from people that were brought in as slaves from the Cape Malay regions and so forth, and even the Africans that were already in South Africa and how they've interpreted and used the language. So at the moment, Afrikaans is more a mix of different influences, but predominantly associated with the history of the Dutch settlers. And Afrikaans is also a language that is associated with the Dutch people that settled in South Africa, who are white settlers, essentially. So because of that, Afrikaans has been seen as a language of the colonial oppressor. So there's a contestation against the use of Afrikaans from the perspective that this is the language of the oppressor. And so non-Afrikaner people historically did not want to use the language Afrikaans. But interestingly enough, now there are more non-white Afrikaans speakers in some parts of the country, like in Cape Town, where the largest racial group that speaks Afrikaans is actually colored and not white. So there are those nuances. And then on the other hand, there's also a contestation between white Afrikaans speakers, white Afrikaners, and white English speakers. This stems from the historical conflicts between the English imperialists and the Dutch settlers, which led to the Anglo-Boer War. And then eventually Afrikaans became recognized as an official language. Initially Dutch was added to English and then Afrikaans later recognized. So there's also that level of contestation between Afrikaans and English, and then also between African languages and Afrikaans.
Alongside the legacy colonial languages, a range of indigenous languages are also recognized as part of South Africa's official linguistic landscape.
There are also other African languages that are not spoken as widely. Minority languages like Khoisan and even Sign language, which has only this year become formally recognized as the 12th official language of South Africa. So language has a lot of different dimensions.
In South Africa, language policy has been shaped strongly by the racial violence of apartheid, another example that highlights the connections between language, identity, and colonial oppression. From 1948, the South African government operated a policy of systemic discrimination against the non-white population, which included stigmatizing indigenous African languages and valuing them as inferior to Afrikaans or English. Language policy was a source of tension throughout the apartheid era, particularly in the education system. Language protests were at the heart of one of the most infamous instances of state violence committed against the civilian population in the apartheid era, during the 1976 Soweto Uprising.
Afrikaans had always been taught in the schooling system, but a decision was made to make Afrikaans the only language in high school, so after primary school education. And this added up to this tension that had been mounting, this political tension. And so it culminated in the Soweto Uprising, where thousands of school children were injured and some were killed. And I think that is the one sort of incident that really highlights how contentious language has been in South Africa's past.
Fortunately, today the situation is very different from the dark days of apartheid. Following the end of apartheid in 1994, the architects of the Democratic South African State developed a new official language policy, which included 9 indigenous African languages alongside Afrikaans and English. This inclusive approach was designed as a break from the past and aimed to reflect the different linguistic communities of the new Rainbow Nation. In the new South Africa, language diversity would be used as a source of unity, rather than as a source of conflict. And this idea is reflected in the country today.
In terms of bringing people together, I don't know if you follow any sport. South Africa right now has had a brilliant weekend. We won in the cricket match. We won in the rugby match against England. And everyone has been celebrating. But what I found particularly interesting is how media is used in South Africa to highlight language as a way of unifying the state. It's a way of nation building. So you'll see in a lot of the adverts around supporting the Springboks, our rugby team, it's always in several languages. It incorporates different cultures, different colors, different songs, and brings people together, even in the media. So that, in a way, highlights just how intricately language and politics is intertwined in South Africa.
With that, we've reached the end of our whistle-stop tour of key language dynamics and conflicts in India, Canada, and South Africa. With that foundation in place, we'll return in part two to take a closer look at the multi-level governance aspects of language policy in our focus countries and explore what these cases might tell us about how language issues could be approached in multilingual, multi-level countries. Will we find the answer to the question of language policy in federations?
People sometimes say, oh, we've got to find a solution to this. We've got to turn this off. This issue is too difficult. Many of these questions, language and culture and national affirmation, are simply part of the tissue of a complex country. And to think that there is a solution or resolution to them is not a good intellectual pursuit, because it is just not going to happen. These feelings, these, in some cases, resentments, in some cases, sources of pride, affirmation, these are all part of the tissue of a diverse society and will continue to be.
That was Forum Fedcast. Huge thanks to our guests, Leslie Seidel, Asha Sarangi, Linda Cardinal, Miranda Hura, and Michelle Maziwisa.
In this series, we've only had time to discuss a fraction of the countries covered in the Forum's Language Policy Research Project. So, if you'd like to know more about language policy in federations, you can check out the Forum's upcoming compendium of language policy research, Language Policy in Federal and Devolved Countries, The Collected Works. It'll be available for free at the Forum website. Stay tuned to the Forum's social media channels and website for more exciting info about our upcoming publications and events. You can also find us on Twitter at ForumFed and as the Forum of Federations on Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn. Drop us a line and say hi.
We'll be back soon with part two of our language policy miniseries. But before then, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts on federalism and language policy to podcast@forumfed.org. That's podcast@forumfed.org. Get in touch and tell us what you think, and let us know what subjects you would like to be covered in future episodes. For previous episodes of the podcast, just search Forum Fedcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Podbean. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review on your platform of choice. This episode was hosted by
me, Jamie Thomas,
and me, Liam Whittington. It was written and produced by Liam Whittington. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Forum Fedcast.